Hi, this is Paul. Some of you are very much expecting this video. Marcus, up there in the beautiful land of Northern Ireland, arranged a conversation between Paul Kingsnorth and Tom Holland. And of course, I knew when he told me he was going to do that, I knew I was going to watch it. What I was unprepared for was just how wonderful a conversation it was. Now, the conversation begins the first 15 minutes. They go over kind of themes that you sort of expect to hear from Paul Kingsnorth and Tom Holland, Tom Holland's thesis in Dominion, and a bunch of those different things. And then what happens about 15 minutes in, 16, 17 minutes in, is Marcus was smart to sort of back out, and because Tom sort of goes into inquiry mode, he wants to know. And this isn't the rest is history. This is, and it's what follows is really beautiful. And this is one of the, I think, loveliest explorations of faith. And what makes this so good is that it's, Tom is in this place that many, many other people are. The people that I talk to about faith right now. And Paul Kingsnorth was as well. They were in different places. And I can't think like they can because I'm not them. My story is different from theirs. And Paul Kingsnorth has obviously come to faith in this Romanian monastery that is not too far from his house, obviously, because that's where he goes to worship. And Tom continues to explore this. And this whole conversation was just amazing. So definitely watch it, but I'll play some of it and talk about it.
Of original sin that happened in the 60s, I think is one of the kind of profound theological upheavals in Western Christendom, because it has kind of the repudiation of the idea that...
And I'm seriously waiting for Tom Holland to write this book, because... super excited about it if he ever does it.
That we're all sinners, all of us, even the most perfect, even those who sit in judgment on others are infected by sin. It's actually incredibly democratic. And has kind of resulted, I think, in the virtue spiral that we're living in at the moment.
Well, what we've also done is immanentized the eschaton, of course. We've taken the notion that what we're supposed to be doing is, as well as living in a certain way here, preparing for something else. If it seems to me that, and this is one of the things I've been writing about in my essays quite a lot, because it was one of the things I realized while I was writing them, that, you know, the Christian journey is still unfolding for me. So there's all sorts of things I'm realizing every day. But the obvious reality that once you take God out of the picture, you only have the material realm. And then you start to deal with the desire for heaven in the material realm, which becomes utopia, which then becomes a political aim, and it's to be achieved on earth through either politics or technology. That takes us into the age of everything that happened in the 20th century.
And of course, you try to bring down heaven, you wind up pulling up hell.
The desire for utopian ideologies to create a heaven on earth, but then it takes us also into what's happening.
And of course, if you've never watched Mark's channel, he tends to put these book recommendations in during the talk, which I always find fun.
The 21st, which is where we try to achieve the same thing with technology, it seems to me, where we move towards transhumanism and we attempt to live forever and we attempt to create our own intelligent beings. And the same thing is happening where we have not just the removal of original sin, but we have the removal of any transcendent realm at all, because we don't believe in that anymore. There's no evidence for it. The science doesn't support it. And so we end up with our Christian desire for transcendence and heaven and regeneration trying to do it here, it seems to me. And so we do that through politics, we do that through revolution, we do that through technology. And so it's as if, you know, Western humanity has severed itself from the source of its values and denies them, but can't stop behaving as if they were still there. But now they're centered in us. So we become the gods, we become the creators. And that's the thing that really disturbs me.
And I think it's a great... Part of what happens with these guys is they keep talking about this because these ideas are fresh. People want to hear them. They go on channels. They keep working on these ideas. They keep processing them. Both Paul Kingsnorth and Tom Holland are continue to work on these things, and the longer they work on them, the sharper, the tighter, the more defined. That's just sort of the natural process, and it's really wonderful to see this continue to develop and sharpen. And at this point, Tom Holland takes over the interview.
What we think we can create with that power.
So how has becoming a Christian affected your sense of that? Because presumably before becoming a Christian, did you have a sense that it was, I mean, did the Christian language of heaven and redemption have meaning for you?
And just the way he's asking the question, you know, he's in earnest, and you can just tell by the timbre of his voice. This is not an interview, just a normal interview. He really wants to know.
I don't think it did. I don't think I liked any of the Christian language, and it's one of the reasons I was so sort of reluctant to become Christian when I became Christian.
But you were on a kind of constant religious quest, weren't you?
I was
looking for transcendence, perhaps.
I was looking for truth, I suppose. I mean, I was looking for truth, whatever that meant.
Now, it's important to note that earlier in this conversation, Marcus asked a question, and basically these two sort of split. Tom is talking about apocalyptic, and Paul is talking about mythology. And so actually they come at this from two ways. Paul was living in an enchanted world and in some way was looking to understand the truth behind the enchanted world. And as you'll see, Tom is living in a modern world and is looking for the enchantment and desires to live into the enchantment, whereas Paul is trying to make sense of the enchantment that he's always felt.
And for at least a decade, I've been doing that very consciously. I was practicing Buddhism for a long time. Yeah. And then, as I said, I was looking through neo-paganism. I was looking in myths. As a younger man, I'd been a kind of activist, very interested in politics. So that was where I was looking for it then. It felt like I was sort of climbing up the rungs of the ladder of divine ascent, starting on the bottom with politics and then working my way up through culture and trying to find out whatever the hell the truth was. But I didn't ever think that Christianity had a handle on it or had it, because I don't know. I think that
Now, one of the things, if you look at, let's say, what Andrew Tate had to say about Christianity and why he went to Islam, there's definitely something about Christianity in the UK in terms of it's sort of this assumed religion, and the assumption is that Christianity is just so astoundingly nominal that nobody can take it seriously. And part of the revolution, at least in the UK, seems to be people standing up and beginning to take it seriously, but in a way that is compelling for others.
The default assumption in the West, certainly maybe if you're my generation, which is probably your generation too, is that Christianity is meaningless, really. It doesn't, it's a bit shallow, and it's crude, and there's heaven and hell. And
that's nearly what Andrew Tate said about why he went to Islam.
And there's a God in the sky, and then there's a devil, and we don't really believe in any of these things anymore.
Well, there is that, but also there's the sense that actually there isn't really a belief in anything very much, that it's all a bit bland and dull.
In Christianity itself, you mean?
Well, certainly in English Christianity, maybe less so in Irish Christianity.
Well, I think there's both. I think there's both, isn't there? Because the strange thing is, certainly when I was growing up, you had had this remnant sense in the Christianity that you saw that there were a load of stories that you didn't believe in. But then, as you say, there was a sense increasingly that the church didn't really believe in them either.
Yeah, and so it's simultaneously rebarbative and dull.
And that's, Paul puts his finger on it right there. The church didn't believe it either. And that's why I think part of the reason that strange Christians, odd Christians, Christians who have skin in the game, and this isn't just in terms of Christianity, this is in terms of people are looking to, the only valid people seem to be the ones who have skin in the game with these kinds of religions that sort of break from the cultural norm.
Oh, yeah, which is never a good.
Yeah, it's not a good.
Never a good look.
And the basic the basic story is you wouldn't go there if you were looking for truth, because it didn't seem to be at all robust, which is presumably why things like Buddhism, for example, have taken off across the West so much. I mean, there are various versions of Buddhism, and some of them are very shallow, but But
actually, part of what's happened in California, where there's been so many Western American Buddhists, is that for many people, it's like, yeah, you're a Buddhist just like everybody else. You have the statue in your backyard, and I preached a sermon years ago. I mean, would you put Buddha in your bathroom? Because people all over California, they're in their rush to climb the ladder of economic success, seem to bathe themselves in little Buddha statues. And I always found that to be a very odd thing. You're sort of trying to get away from attachments as you're attaching yourself to American consumerism.
Their heart, Buddhism, or even Islam, has a story to tell that it believes in. And Western Christianity, certainly in the form I'd seen it in, it didn't have that story. And I thought I knew the story. I thought I knew what the story was. And I thought it was nonsense. And it was only when I started getting drawn towards Christianity and reading the Gospels properly and going to church and reading theology and talking to people that I realized, especially from the Orthodox perspective, because I ended up in the Orthodox Church, that the story I thought I'd been hearing was not actually the story that had been being told for 2,000 years. It was a sort of, I don't know, a post-Enlightenment myth, I suppose, or maybe it was just a version designed to appeal to the masses that didn't really appeal to anyone.
So as someone who is who ended up becoming Orthodox, do you feel that the entire history of the Western churches, the Latin churches, has been a wrong turn?
What a question!
Yeah, it's a good question, isn't it? What do I say to that? It's sort of yes and no, I suppose. I don't theologically know enough to say yes, but I also think that something went wrong in the West when I asked an Orthodox priest once, what's the fundamental difference between Western and Eastern Christianity? And he said, touched his heart, and he said, the East is here and the West is here. And I think
what's so interesting about this conversation and what he just said there is I've heard so many evangelicals talking about that. That's you find this same sentiment. Now, obviously, it's different with, within, let's say, American evangelical Protestants. But, all the time you can hear Tim Keller say similar things. So but I don't want to sort of cheapen that observation, because it actually has a lot to do with this question about nominal or merely performative social cultural Christianity versus people who clearly mean it. And maybe here in the United States, we just have this larger population of people who are willing to be weird for Jesus, either in pleasing or offensive ways.
Broadly, that's the truth. There's a lot of theological discussions you could have about the filioque clause and things and the reasons that the church is split if you want to do that. But the fact is that for the first 1,000 years, there was a church and we share the same saints, including all the early saints of Britain and Ireland that we were talking about earlier. And then we don't. And the direction that the West goes in seems to be highly rationalized. And it ends up leading us towards, by accident, I think, maybe through nominalism and various other things, into a reformation which sort of gets out of control and leads us into secular liberalism. But the whole...
Now I think his rationalization point is a good one. I made... Nate Heil and I, again, spoke today, had, made a similar point. You know, part of Calvinism very much became very rationalist religion. Of course, Molly Worthen's great book on American neo-evangelicalism, Apostles of Reason, she really picks up on that. The Anabaptists, of course, had their own particular biblicism in action rather than sort of in dogmatic rationalism. And I think figuring out the Orthodox and what happens to Orthodoxy is going to be very interesting with respect to this. And I by no means have my... I just continue to get data from the disparate sources of both people who have gone to Orthodoxy and some contact with some Orthodox clergy. But it's interesting how this is going to be.
Trend seems to be towards much more of a rationalization of God, the mysticism. When I was looking, when I started exploring Christianity, I was exploring Catholicism and Anglicanism and everything. I didn't initially think I'd be an Orthodox Christian. That would have been an odd thing. But I was looking for, I think I was looking for the mystical heart of the faith, the sort of thing that I saw in the Desert Fathers and the sort of thing that I saw in some of the great classic Western.
And so when you...
Okay, and about the mysticism now, Grimger has just had Nate Heil on his channel a couple of days ago, and Nate Heil told a great story about how he had a near-death experience when he was young, when he was 14 years old, and had this sense of everything's going to be okay. I don't have time to put this video together as much as I'd like, but I was thinking about playing that clip because it's important, because part of, I think, what happens with God gets a hold of each of us often in different ways. Sometimes it'll be through an experience. And this is part of the reason why, for some people, psychedelics do provide a gateway in. And this Sunday I preached a little bit about the Jesus people. Of course, that whole movement was dripping with psychedelics. But others have experiences, and Tom is going to talk about this when he talks about his Bible reading a little bit later. We'll see if we have time to get to that if I don't talk too much. With these videos, I'm always trying to balance, because just to replay their video, I don't need to do that. It's already out there. But I also know that some of you won't even know about this video unless I make it known and show you some of the value of this video. I very much encourage finding this video. The link is below in the comments, and watching the whole video. This is my third time. I'm going to watch this video a lot, because this conversation has within it, I think, this is what I'm looking for, because of course I'm an evangelist in many ways, and I want to understand, and I can only understand what's going on in the broader culture and in people like Paul Kingsnorth and Tom Holland and Douglas Murray and Jordan Peterson and how many other individuals, if I listen carefully to them, and that often requires listening to them again and again and again to sort of get a clear picture of what's going on in this.
When you found that, did you recognize it as something that you'd been looking for in Buddhism, in paganism, maybe even in the environmentalism that was your focus in your early decades?
I think I did.
I mean, I know it still is, but
yeah, no, it did, and it felt like a culmination of something. It was very strange when you come into the Orthodox Church. Everybody says welcome home to you, and it's a very strange thing to say.
It's really funny, because I hear these little stories coming out of Orthodoxy, and I think, I've heard so much of this in campy American evangelical places, you know? Christianity isn't a religion, it's a relationship. Welcome home. It has to go from the head to the heart. I mean, there's a fair amount of this in various traditions of pietism that have come over from Europe, too.
If you've just gone into the Romanian church and you're not Romanian and you've never been Orthodox. But in another way, it's fundamentally true. What happened to me was I got hunted by Christ, and then I thought, okay, I'm going to have to be a Christian after a while. This is where I have to be. And I thought it was true because I didn't want it to be true. And numerous things happened, which I won't go into. But once I decided I was a Christian, I started looking for the heart of Christianity. And yes, when I found the Orthodox monastic tradition, especially, and the mystical tradition around hesychasm and the Jesus prayer and what happens in Mount Athos and other places like that, I thought, this is something I've been looking for longer than I knew I was looking for it. I never thought that would be true. And a friend of mine, Martin Shaw, who became a...
I haven't watched anything from Martin Shaw, but he's very much in orbit. So they are going to have, Marcus talked about, they are going to have an event in, I don't know if Marcus is going to have it at his place, where Paul and I met not too while ago, but with Jonathan Peugeot and Martin Shaw and Paul Kingsnorth, and that should be quite good. But again, you have the sense in this context of nominalism, where Christianity has become sort of ossified and unsurprising, and sort of domesticated to the point of becoming background noise, you sort of need a strangeness. You need a more chaotic Christianity. to sort of liven it up.
Christian quite recently as well. He's a mythologist and another one of these people you'd never have expected to be a Christian. He said something interesting. He said, I didn't convert to Christianity. I just discovered that I'd always been a Christian all along. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the same thing happened to me, actually, in a strange way.
And of course, that meshes with Holland's. This is where Holland is interesting in terms of his thesis of dominion, which has been that we simply can't understand ourselves. Now, I don't know if it's coming up later or if it was before, where King's North basically makes the observation that, who said it? Ivan Illich. I think it was before this point where Ivan Illich said, we're in a deeply Christian age. And even though everything feels post-Christian, yet this is the part earlier before 15 minutes where Paul is making the point that, even the critics of Christianity are using Christianity, and their complaint against Christians is that they're not Christian enough.
That I felt this was exactly what I'd been looking for, but I never would have looked there for it unless I'd been sort of grabbed by the scruff of the neck and taken there.
Is when I think of your environmental writings, what they gave me was a sense of humanity's sin.
That's interesting.
That the scale of the crisis facing not just humanity, but every living creature on this earth because of us was a drama on a cosmic scale with really no prospect of redemption or salvation. But
now that point he makes there, I can't just stay here. I've got to pull up other things that I know of. This piece, The Strange Persistence of Guilt by Wilfred M. McClay. This came out, spring of 2017. This was a while ago. I remember reading this. And now Nietzsche, of course, in some ways, Nietzsche is deep beneath Tom Holland's work, Dominion. And Nietzsche sort of grabbed a hold of Tom Holland, and Nietzsche, of course, was a classicist, and is very formative in this whole moment. Of course, Peterson has paid a lot of attention to Nietzsche, but what Holland just said there is very much in keeping with this. Those of us living in the developed world of the West find ourselves in the tightening grip of a paradox, one whose shape and character has so far largely eluded our understanding. It is the strange persistence of guilt as a psychological force in modern life. If anything, the word persistent understates the matter. Guilt is not merely lingering. It has grown, even metastasized, into an even more powerful and pervasive element in the life of the contemporary West. Even as the rich language formerly used to define it has withered and faded from discourse, the means of containing its effects, let alone obtaining relief from it, have become even more elusive. This paradox has set up a condition in which the phenomenon of guilt rising becomes both a byproduct of and an obstacle to civilizational advance. The stupendous achievements of the West in forming the material conditions of human life and extending the blessings of liberty and dignity to more and more people are in danger of being countervailed and even negated by a growing burden of guilt that poisons our social relations and hinders our effects to live happily and harmonious lives. It goes down to Nietzsche on the genealogy of morality. See if I can find. Such guilt is hard to identify and hard to understand, though since it frequently dwelled in an unconscious level, it could easily be mistaken for something else. It often appears, as Freud argues, as sort of malaise, a dissatisfaction, for people seek other explanations, whether external or internal. Guilt is crafty, a trickster, a chameleon, capable of disguising itself, hiding out, changing its size and appearance, even its location, all the while managing to persist and deepen. I've got this. I've got a full version of it somewhere. I know I whisked that away when I read it because I knew I would need it. He makes the point that for many people, there's no place to get rid of this guilt. How can you get rid of it? Let's say with all of your Western privilege or your white privilege or your wealth privilege. I mean, how can you get away from the burden of what you've done? And this is where Holland, it very much connects with this question of the ruining of the planet. The Rest Is History this morning just came out with one on climate apocalypse, which Dominic Sandbrook named for the spicier podcast clickbaitedness.
Certainly, you know, the language of apocalypse, the mood of apocalypse was there. But of course, apocalypse, it's a book in the Bible.
Yeah, absolutely.
Literally, a parting of the veil. When you look back at that, at how you felt then, presumably without a sense of God, without a sense that there might be a kind of a meaning that transcends.
And again, notice, Holland's going to come at it from apocalypse. King's North is going to come at it from mythology. And that's where, in some ways, people might look at these people and say, oh, this is the same thing. It's not really the same thing. They're coming at it from different ends. For King's North, if you listen to a story, he's told a story in a number of different places, the world was always enchanted, and he wanted to basically find the logos within this enchantment. For Holland, it's much more apocalyptic, and he's looking to believe in this enchanted story. And a little bit later, well, I should just keep playing because it's great.
Sense the natural cycles that are leading the planet towards catastrophe. Mm. Something more than that. Did you feel that? I mean, did it provide a kind of sense of solace that actually there might be, you might be able to have put this kind of apocalyptic language into a broader story?
I think that's a really good observation. I think that to go back to what we were saying earlier about say the heart of progressive politics at the moment and what sort of heresy it is. I mean, I would say the same thing is true of environmentalism to some degree, because what environmentalism does is it hones in with a laser on the utter destructiveness of humanity towards the rest of life, which is completely undeniable. But then, as you say, it's once you get to the real depth of understanding of how big that crisis is, it's very difficult to find any hope. And I didn't have any hope for sure, which is why environmentalists look to politics or mainly these days technology to solve things. But it seems to me, and it gradually became clear all the way through those essays I was writing, that this was, as I said, I was sort of moving up the ladder through politics, through culture, and then to spirituality, that this was
and if you listen to the King's North story, you know, he basically began to recognize that the answer being given to the unintended consequences of technology was more technology. It's sort of like the answer being given to a flood is more water. And he's like, no, that's going in the wrong direction.
This was a spiritual matter, to use the dread word. And that without that sense of transcendence, without the sense of meaning, without the sense that something much bigger than us on this earth and beyond this earth, without a notion that the earth itself in some way is sacred, not necessarily because it's a god, but because there's something in it that is far beyond our rational understanding.
Well, that it's created by God, by a god who's good.
It's
created. So therefore it is, shares in that goodness.
It is, and it has the energy of God in it, in the Orthodox sense. God is everywhere present and filling all things, as it says in the daily prayer.
God number one.
Which is a lovely way of putting it. So you can see God in the forest just as you can see him in another human being. But without that, there's a darkness, and I think I was in that darkness for quite a long time. And it wasn't that I was looking for a religion to save me from it, but when I did come to Christianity, the story made sense. And as you say, it's the sin at the heart of it. I'm consistently fascinated by Genesis and going back to the first few books of Genesis all the time, because the story.
So Genesis more than Revelation.
See, their book ends here.
Yeah, and much more these days, much more. I don't read Revelation much. I mean, probably because I don't understand it properly, but I'm much less interested in apocalypse now than I am in what we are and what we're created to be. The gap between what we were created to be and what we are, what we've been tempted into being, seems to me to be the huge gap that we ignore. And again, so central to the Christian story, this notion that we were created to be something other than we've ended up being.
And so what do you find in Genesis then that draws you to reading it? What truths?
Well, what I find is that if you look in the garden, here we are.
Notice he asked what truths, and that's going to be important in a minute.
Garden. We're created we're put into this garden. We're created last. we're the youngest things in the garden. And in this garden, everything's in communion with everything else. So God is so close that you can see him walking in the garden in the cool of the evening, which is such a great image. Everything is close to everything else. Nothing's eating anything else. It's all plant-based food, so it's very contemporary. And we are being trained. We're being trained to be God's apprentices, or rather we are God's apprentices. We're being trained for theosis, which is union with God. We're designed to tend and keep this place. And the only thing we have to not do is eat this fruit, which will give us the knowledge of good and evil, because we're not ready for it, because that separates us from everything else. But of course, there's another presence in the garden, and this presence is opposed to the creator and opposed to the creation. And this is the presence this is the adversary, this is the devil, and he's inside us as well as everywhere else. This force that opposes God and opposes this unity. And the word devil comes from diabolos, which means to divide, which is what the devil does. So we divide, we choose to be tempted, we choose the knowledge of good and evil, we're not ready for it. And as soon as we do that, we're separated from everything else, and everything sickens and separates from us. So this union we had with everything that's created, and this training we were undergoing to become God's lieutenants, if you like, is all broken, and we have to leave the garden. It's not even as if we're expelled as a punishment. We can't be there anymore. So we're down here, and then we have to break the world, and we have to eat everything, and we have to give birth in agony.
So you said, I mean, you said that there was a time where you were looking for truth in myth, and clearly this is a myth. So, you know, it's a myth.
Now, remember Tom's story, and you can find it in Dominion, because Tom goes to Sunday school as a nice young Anglican lad and a little boy who's excited about dinosaurs and wants to find out where. You know, where do dinosaurs and the Sunday school class come together?
Of a kind that you might find in Greek or Indian or whatever mythologies. But to become a Christian is presumably to accept that it's a myth that's true. So in what sense is it true? Is it something more perhaps than just a myth, do you think?
Well, to me, it's a foundational story. So it's not true in the literal sense that there is a garden somewhere on this earth where two people were created in 7 days, etc., in the biblical literal sense. But it's a story which tells us what we were originally created to be. And in some sense, at some point, we were in that place.
Now, this is where, I'm going to get into a little bit of trouble with this. This is, of course, where the East has to come to terms with the questions of the West. And that's, you know, even though both of these men are from the West, Paul grew up in England, if I remember correctly. He moved to Ireland. He's not originally Irish. But what about this question? And it's sort of easy to say, well, the heart, not the head. And now, obviously, these kinds of issues won't impact everyone the same. And for Paul Kingsnorth, who always lived in an enchanted world, this just, he found himself, it's a, here's the true world, I've found it. And for Tom's still gonna have to, you can hear Tom wrestling with this in certain elements of the podcast. And you know, I think many of us, and Paul will say, yeah, I've, you know, dealt with this too. And then they're gonna get into faith. Oh, it's just an amazing conversation.
Fine, because it isn't on this earth, so it's not a story in the same way that the Gospels are a story of an eyewitness account of a man who walked on the earth and did things. It's a myth that tells us something really foundational about who we are, but it feeds through to the Gospels, because the coming of Christ is what breaks the hold of death and breaks the hold of sin and gives us an opportunity to eventually go back to the garden, it seems to me, or to eventually have the garden remade on earth. We have a path to follow. And the path is humility, and humility comes from the same root as the word humus, which is soil, which is also what humans are made of, soil plus the breath of God. So we
Adam,
have this way.
Yeah.
Adam, yeah. Exactly. So we're made of soil. God scoops up soil and breathes onto it. So humans are soil plus the breath of God, which is an amazing image. And
we're the stuff of earth and the breath of God.
What does Christ tell us is the way back? Walking this narrow path with humility. So the way of humus, if you like, we follow the path back through love and sacrifice, and we can go back to the garden. And it's almost like it's a circular story. And it's a story that, as C.S. Lewis said, this is a story that just happens to be true, in my view.
Because you see, I think that this is the to believe this.
Mm.
It's like if you can't swim, trusting yourself to the waters.
Mm, absolutely, yeah.
Wow. If you can't swim, trusting yourself to the waters. That's really good.
And I'm so kind of drawn by the desire to know where trusting, say, the books of the Bible, accepting, believing, trusting that they are part of a whole.
Mm.
Where they would, what it would be like to feel that in the marrow, in the kind of the essence of your being. So I've read the
Bible. Okay, right there before he talks about the Bible reading. So remember when I talked about Nate Heil and his near-death experience at 14? Paul Kingsnorth and the breaking of his environmentalism and his finding himself at home in this Romanian monastery. There is, C.S. Lewis gets at this to a degree in certainly not his best book, A Pilgrim's Regress, but it's haunted by that. And all of C.S. Lewis's books are haunted by this. And I believe that every Christian, so God has somehow pierced our armor and gotten into our hearts, and he goes in different ways. And the real challenge, and we'll get a little bit more into this, the real challenge in this is going to be, how can we make love stay? Now, one of the tensions here is we have these moments of transcendental experience, and it could be, you know, maybe you grew up in a church, and so it's when a particular hymn. I remember my father talking about when he was young in church, and they sang the hymn, you know, "My Jesus, I love thee, I know thou art mine." And even for a Calvinist, you know, Calvinists like myself and my father and my grandfather, so I wonder when my grandfather was baptized, because that whole story of the Jews in Western Michigan, I'm not quite sure how it went, but I can imagine my father in his father's church somewhere in Wisconsin or Minnesota in a dirt poor prairie where the Depression era CRC farmers don't have enough money to pay the pastor, but you know, his heart was strangely warmed, and God finds his way into us. And then so often, and again, Lewis writes about this, God just gives us just this sense and says, no, you're not going to live there. You're not going to live in that moment of, in Nate Heil's case, when he's 14 years old and he very well may die. And in a sense, you know, God comes to him and says, I have you. It will be okay. You know, don't worry. Or my father's hymn, or just a moment that comes when we finally know that. And again, I'm a Calvinist, so here it comes. It's not finally that we have hold of him, but that he has hold of us. And John Van Donkel talk about that in the hollow of his hand. I don't know if John will watch this video. He doesn't watch most of my videos, but then we have to navigate those moments when God gives us this apocalypse, this look behind the veil, and oh, there it is. Oh, I know it to be true. And then those other moments when we, in a sense, those moments of sight versus those moments when we require faith, because we're not seeing it, we're not feeling it, And so we're trying to hold on. It's Peter in the boat saying, "Bid me, Lord." And the Lord says, "Come." And in that moment, he's walking on water, and then he looks down at the wind and the waves and begins to sink. And Jesus says, "Why did you doubt?"
Bible through three times. The essence of your being. So I've read the Bible through three times. And the first time I read it ages ago, as I read the King James Bible, because I wanted to read it as you know, a literary masterpiece, the kind of the prose equivalent of Shakespeare.
Mm.
And then I read it again with a kind of historian's hat on, you know, intrigued to know how and why it came to be put together, what the various recensions were, when they might have been written, who might have written it, all this kind of thing. So a very deconstructive approach.
Mm.
And then having written Dominion and actually having read Origen, and he has this wonderful metaphor for scripture as being a mansion full of many rooms, and each one contains the key to the other room.
Mark that right there.
Yeah. So to unlock one of the doors, you have to find the key in the other room. It's like kind of the idea of an enormous computer game or something.
Yeah.
But I loved that idea, and I thought, I will read the Bible in that spirit. I will park my skepticism. I will park my... what I kind of know about how and why these books came to be written. And I will read it perhaps as I kind of imagine Paul must have consulted scripture after, you know, his vision on the road to Damascus, trying to make sense of it, trying to see how these scriptures might shed light on the experience that he'd had and his understanding of who or what Jesus might have been. And it was probably... Even in terms of trying to make sense of the past, that one of the most valuable things I've ever done, I felt that I was slipping the moorings of 20th century skepticism, and that it was opening my eyes to how people in the past had seen the world, and not just Christians.
Slipping the moorings.
It kind of opened me to the possibility of wonder and strangeness and connections that today we can barely even see. And well, you know,
and so now notice again, King's North. Now this story isn't in this video. I've listened to enough King's North videos, and I met him when I was in Ireland, and with his he's in a sense he's always known the enchanted world, and in the church he found his way home, and so he can inhabit the myth of in Genesis, he can inhabit that world-shaping story. And Tom, you know, if you listen to Tom's story, I mean, why did he love the Greeks, the heroic Greeks and the Romans? There was something gleaming through there. And again, there's so much C.S. Lewis behind this as well, because Lewis, of course, saw it in the stories of the North. There was something gleaming through. Lewis would go on and call those... you know, basically the good dreams. Again, I should reread C.S. Lewis's Pilgrim's Regress, because so much of this is there. Pilgrim's Regress is one of his weaker books in some ways, because I'm sure Tolkien didn't like it, because there's a lot of sort of thin allegory in it. But yet, Lewis is still working on these issues, and so in the sense, both Tom and Paul here are. They're recognizing when God slipped into their lives when they were young, and now later in adulthood, kind of popping in and saying, "Remember me? Do you remember me?"
I kind of feel envious of you, I guess, that you can do that all you know, absolutely all the time, that you don't have to kind of set your mind in a special groove to get to that.
I mean, I don't know. It's funny, you know, because look, I studied history at Oxford as well, and I have this critical mind, and there's always a tension probably between in all of us between rationalism and romanticism, or rationalism and spirituality, because us here anyway, sort of intellectual Western types. So there's always a critical voice saying, "Well, is that true? Is that true?"
But it's slipping the moorings of that.
You have to put more into that. Yeah, and the way you do that, that's what faith is. That's what the leap of faith is. That's where you take the jump and you say it.
Now, remember, slipping the moorings. Well, what is that? That's the boat heading off. Now, if you listen to enough, the rest is history. Neither Tom nor Dominic will volunteer themselves to be navigational nautical experts beyond the boat shoes of the Kaiser. But slipping the moorings, he wants to. He's ready to sail away to the distant shore. And I can almost think of Tolkien and the Fair Havens.
You know, I believe this. I often hear people these days saying, well, I'm going to act like I believe this. But you have to go further than that. You have to say, I believe this, and just believe it. And, you know,
what I realized was that believing it opens up kind of a sense of whole new vistas that otherwise you wouldn't be there. You know, again, to pursue that metaphor, it opens up a door that otherwise will remain locked. And, exactly. and beyond that door are further rooms and further rooms and further rooms.
And my understanding of this is exactly how God works. You see, when you say, I believe this, it's not a final declaration that you have a bunch of opinions you're never going to change. It's a declaration that you are walking into something in faith and you're holding out your hand and someone's going to take your hand and help you to keep walking. And that's what happens. Like you say, it is like walking into the room and saying, well, where the hell's the key? And then you find the key, and then you walk into the next room and you find the key, and it's not a coincidence that this is happening. But the faith comes through saying, yeah, I believe this, and saying it to God and saying it to yourself and saying it to other people, and then just dealing with the fact that lots of people are going to think you've gone mad and you're probably going to lose readers and all the rest of it. I have a friend, older friend.
I have to pull up something that came on Quest. So we're having the conference, the Quest for a Spiritual Home in Chino in May, in Chino, California, in May with Jonathan Peugeot and John Verveke. And so I'm making some videos about this quest. And Michael Brockman messages us about Quest from a quote from Alistair MacIntyre. The medieval conception of a quest is not at all that of a search for something already adequately characterized as miners search for gold or geologists for oil. It is the course of the quest, and only through the encountering and coping with the various particular harms, dangers, temptations, and distractions which provide any quest with its episodes and incidents that the goal of the quest is finally to be understood. A quest is always an education both as to the character of that which is sought and in self-knowledge. And I think that's very much what slipping the moorings, what Tom is looking for. And when Tom says to Paul, you know, that you can live in it, and I'm sure part of Paul is like, well, I don't really live in it, because again, there's the moments of apocalypse where we see behind the veil, but Moses comes down from the mountain, and of course the two versions of the veil covering. He covers his face because his glowing face disturbs the children of Israel, but the fading of the glow and being seen as fading disturbs Moses.
A friend who told me a great story the other day about Bob Dylan. He said that he went to see Bob Dylan in the 70s after he converted to Christianity, and he just started to record his Christian albums, and he went to see him at Earl's Court, which apparently can seat 5,000 people. And he said there were about 100 people there because nobody wanted to come. And Dylan came on stage and he said, look, he said, I know I'm called Bob Dylan, but I'm not the person who used to be called Bob Dylan. He said, I'm totally different. And I'm sorry, but I'm not doing any of my old songs tonight because something incredible has happened to me. I'm doing all these new songs. But he said, you know, I'm going to stick around afterwards, and if you want to talk about what's happened to me, we can have a chat. And apparently they did. And that's what happened to Bob Dylan.
And wouldn't you have loved to be in there that night? And this is the beautiful thing. If you can spot God at work, don't chase the crowds. There will always be crowds. Don't chase the crowds. Slip in where there are a few, but the real thing is going on. Wouldn't you have loved to have been in the crowd that night? I'm going to have to draw this to a close soon, but
he just severed himself from everything, but you know, he's still there.
Knocking on heaven's door.
That's the, you know, you have to prepare to that act of saying, I believe this, is going to change your life. And if you told me 5 years ago that I was going to do that and then be here talking about it, I would have never believed it. But here we are.
It's very, very interesting.
It's very strange. But yeah, that's that little skeptical demon in you on your shoulder, which is on my shoulder too, is always the danger. He's always there going, no. I know when this book was written and it wasn't really that, and it might not have been Mark anyway, and all of this stuff, you know, that's always there. And you can't, you know, you should never get rid of that entirely, because then you're open to any old nonsense.
Any old rubbish.
Exactly. Yes. Then there's the leap of faith. That's the thing. And we, I do feel, like you say, 20th and 21st century Western skepticism is so weird and unusual in historical terms.
It certainly is,
even in global terms, you know, it's just not a normal way to behave.
No.
But we think it is. And it does get in the way of a felt experience of life in so many ways.
Yeah. Marcus.
Hey, Tom. Hey.
Oh, yeah. It's my YouTube channel. But Marcus is in no way bothered by this. This is exactly what he looks for when he puts this video together. So this is a good place to stop. And you should, when you're done watching this, you should definitely go down in the link below and click this and go watch the whole thing, because the whole thing is great. One of, you know, just a 5-star video. I watched this and thought, oh yeah, this is a good one. This is a good one. And why is it a good one? Because, you know, whether it's, you know, 14-year-old Nate Heil, who has to face death at an age like that, and God basically communicates to him that, no, I've got you, Nate. Or it's peeking behind the veil, slipping the moorings, reading the Bible, and in the process of reading the Bible, getting close enough to taste the far off country. It's good. So, leave a comment. I've got to draw this to an end.